This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.
The Biden administration sees its first failed cabinet pick. So just who could be the new nominee to run the budget office? Plus, businesses in Texas will soon fully open and masks won't be required. Which other states have removed mask mandates? And there's a chance you'll get your COVID-19 vaccine at a drugstore. We'll tell you what the big chains will get in return.
They now have this trove of email addresses, cell phone numbers, of all these people who may not otherwise have walked through the front door of their pharmacy.
It's Wednesday, March 3rd. I'm Mark Stewart with the Wall Street Journal, and this is What's News. President Biden's nominee to lead the Office of Management and Budget has been withdrawn by the White House. Neera Tanden asked the administration to take her out of consideration amid opposition from Senate Republicans and a key Democrat. Here's White House reporter Andrew Restuccia on who might be nominated in her place.
The top choice to replace her, according to people that we've spoken to, is Shalonda Young, who's currently nominated to be the deputy OMB director. She spent about a dozen or so years on the House Appropriations Committee as a staffer. She's well-liked by members of both parties. She happened to actually have a confirmation hearing for her deputy director role, and she received praise from Republicans and Democrats. The expectation is that if she were to be nominated, that she would be able to be confirmed.
The president said in a statement that he still looked forward to having Tanden serve in a role in the administration. In Texas, the nation's second largest state, businesses will soon be able to operate at full capacity, and state residents won't have to wear masks to visit them. Here's Governor Greg Abbott.
Too many Texans have been sidelined from employment opportunities. Too many small business owners have struggled to pay their bills. This must end.
The easing of restrictions will take effect on March 10th. It joins other states which have removed mask mandates, such as Iowa and North Dakota. The White House said it disagreed with decisions by Texas and some states to lift their mask mandates and other restrictions. Democrats in the New York State Legislature have moved to strip Governor Andrew Cuomo of management powers granted to him during the pandemic. The governor has faced mounting criticism of his handling of COVID-19 in nursing homes. A spokesman for Governor Cuomo didn't immediately comment on the resolution. Meanwhile, more lawmakers have called for the governor's resignation after a third woman accused him of inappropriate behavior. A spokesman for Governor Cuomo didn't respond to requests for comment on the latest accusation. He hasn't made any public appearances since Thursday. We have all of the details on WSJ.com. And in California, at least 13 people have died after a crash between a packed SUV and a semi-truck near the Mexico border. Authorities say the Ford Expedition was carrying 25 passengers, many of whom weren't wearing seatbelts. Our regular listeners know we've talked a lot about SPACs on the podcast. Known as blank check companies, it's a way for a business to become publicly traded without the traditional IPO listing process. Now, overseas, the London Stock Exchange may ease the rules, making it more appealing to list SPACs there. Markets editor Quinton Webb joins me now. Good to have you on this morning, Quinton.
Hi, Mark.
Quinton, SPACs are already used in the UK, but the game could be changing in part because of Brexit.
That's right. So London is considering easing its listing rules when it comes to SPACs so the city can better compete with New York as a venue for these vehicles. And as you say, in a way, this is tied to Brexit because London or Britain is kind of keen to maintain the city's relevance as a major international financial centre, even whilst It is losing some of its tight links to the European Union. Brexit, of course, has made it a little bit difficult in some ways. So, for example, some share trading has shifted out of London and to Amsterdam. And we should say that London is not the only market that is eyeing the big boom in SPACs in America with envy, because in Asia too, you know, exchanges in Hong Kong and in Singapore are thinking as well about whether they might be able to introduce SPACs. It's the hottest phenomenon in global capital markets in some ways at the moment, and you know, various people want in on the action.
Quinton, what else is the UK looking at to maintain its presence as a financial hub?
Well, you know, the other hot story in global markets really is the rise and rise of tech companies, which often, you know, entails hot IPOs and lots of trading volume, very high valuations. Now, in an effort partly to appeal to technology company founders, I think, you know, the London is considering dropping its traditional principle of one share, one vote, and allowing companies with dual class shares or super voting rights for the founders to come to market. So that is a way of trying to bring fresh blood into the London market, a place that has until recently been dominated by rather old economy companies like banks, mining companies, oil companies, and so on.
Quinton Webb, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
Just ahead, the big data reward for pharmacy chains when you get your COVID-19 shot. We'll be right back.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
Big name pharmacy chains are proving to be one of the go-to places for people to get a COVID-19 vaccination. While you get a shot, the pharmacies also get something of value, access to millions of customers' data. So what information will these companies be getting, and what exactly will they be doing with it? Our reporter Sharon Turlip has been asking these questions, and she joins me now from New York. Sharon, good morning.
Good morning.
So Sharon, exactly what information are these stores getting from you?
It depends both on the store, which retailer, and where you are in the process. And CVS and Walgreens, the two biggest drugstore chains in the country, have different approaches. So with Walgreens, you actually need to sign on to an account to search before you can search for a vaccine. And in that case, you're giving your name, your email, your phone number, and permission for Walgreens to track the IP address and your location on your phone. CVS is similar, although you don't provide CVS information until you're at the point of booking an appointment. And at that point, for both companies, when you book an appointment, you're giving them information about your age, where you live, some health information as well.
And why is this information so valuable?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple reasons. So, and we spent some time talking to the drugstores. Part of it is important in terms of making sure you are eligible for a shot, making sure you're, you know, in the right priority list, making sure you are who you say you are. But one thing, and CVS in particular has been pretty vocal about this, is important because it gives them access to consumers, consumer data. They now have this trove of email addresses, cell phone numbers of all these people who may not otherwise have walked through the front door of their pharmacy.
And Sharon, with that information, what can be done with it?
That's an interesting question, because it depends partially on what consumers allow. So these companies are not allowed to take healthcare information and use it for marketing. Like they can't, for example, if you sign up and you say, hey, I'm allergic to this, they can't then start trying to sell you allergy medicine. Or if you say you're diabetic, they can't then try to, you know, market insulin to you. However, they can give consumers options to opt in for more information sharing. They can ask consumers, hey, do you want to join up for a loyalty program? In which case they would then be able to know what you're buying and kind of track your buying habits. So a lot of it depends on what you decide to share with them.
You mentioned Walgreens and CVS. What do they have to say about this?
Sure. It's interesting. They've taken kind of two different responses. CVS actually made a point during their call with investment analysts to talk about how valuable this data was in terms of giving them more ability to reach consumers, to broaden their audience. Walgreens has not made that point. Walgreens has said, you know, we need this information to make sure the right people are getting the vaccine and to make sure that we're compliant with federal reporting requirements.
And finally, Sharon, many of us have heard of HIPAA. It's the federal act that prohibits disclosure of protected health information. Wouldn't this protect our personal data?
Yes, it would. And that's where the issue of opting in to share information comes in. So HIPAA does not allow companies to just kind of scoop up your healthcare data and then either sell it to other entities or use it themselves to market things to you. However, HIPAA says if consumers want that, then they can. So it provides a potential opening for companies to say, hey, would it be helpful? Do you want us to, you know, start kind of maybe tailor our marketing, start offering you services based on your medical history and information? But it's not something that would just happen without the consumer saying that that's what they wanted or that that's okay.
The Journal's Sharon Turlip. Sharon, great to talk to you.
Great talking to you.
And finally, there's something shaking up the gin business. Varieties of the spirit have proliferated, including gins that change color when mixed with tonic. Others are flavored with Brussels sprouts or even beef. But for some, there are questions about whether these new low-alcohol gins still deserve the label. Here's consumer goods and retail reporter Sabra Chowdhury.
There's a slew of non-alcoholic and low-alcohol drinks products on the market that are calling themselves gin, but don't actually meet the minimum alcohol content. And the Gin Guild, which is the big trade body in the UK that internationally tries to protect the reputation of gin, has been pursuing some of these companies and saying, you can't do that, you need to change your name, you can't be calling yourself gin. The counter to that from the guys actually doing this is they say, well, the regulations are out of step with the times. People want low alcoholic products. And in any case, the second rule of gin regulations, which is the juniper predominance, isn't being adhered to. And so why enforce one half of the regulations when you're not enforcing the other half?
We have more on the gin debate on WSJ.com. And that's what's news for Wednesday, halfway through the week. We're back tonight with a new show. As always, we appreciate a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Stewart with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.